Hello everyone, I'm Anil Tripathi, and I'm currently a little happy.
Hello everyone, I'm Ryan Collins, and I am two notches past content.
It's a good way. My name is Adam Gamble, and I'm probably a 6 out of 10 of happy.
So as you guys can hear from our descriptions, we're all at various levels of happiness right now, and we're taking this exercise to really dive into our topic for the moment, ecology of happiness, and thinking about what happiness is to all of us, and also how does it relate to the world around us and our conceptualization of this world? A new book came out, An Ecology of Happiness by Eric Lambin. And in this book, he tries to look at how we can change our perceptions of climate change and the issues involved in such a thing in regards to looking at it in terms of happiness. Can we tackle environmental problems by thinking about what makes us happy? And in that way, come up with solutions that aren't just chores, but actually increase what happiness is to us and whatever this happiness really is.
Yeah, one of the things that Lambin points us towards is this notion of this question he asks is, do we need nature to be happier? What extent do we need nature to be happy? So which to us, of course, spirals out into a series of questions of what is nature? Is it the trees and the rocks that are not human? Is it the outside fresh air? Is it ourselves as part of nature? So what does it mean to talk about sort of an ecology in this case of how life forms are connected? And then also on top of that, how is nature related to our well-being? You know, how do we ourselves think about are we well?
Exactly. And I mean, this is sort of a contentious sort of subject. If we think about the raw image of nature, right, where animals are eating other animals to survive, I mean, the happy tiger is going to be very happy once it eats a big giant squirrel or a big bird, but the bird's not going to be happy. So we have to think about these cycles are happiness and unhappiness, sort of discontent versus something coming else into being.
Mm-hmm.
Mediating those levels with this is a challenge.
It is. And kind of what Lambin draws us to in that regard is that he's asking what can be done to protect the environment, too. So we're talking about nature, environment, and sort of the human's role in conservation, preservation. We can kind of dive into those terms. But what can we do in order to protect the environment that has to do with protecting our own well-being, too, right? And so in the case you're bringing up with the tiger and the bird, Ryan, it's kind of like, how do we make it so that both tiger and bird and us can be happy, right?
It's quite a challenge, right? But it involves a lot of introspection and thinking, what exactly is happiness to us? And I think, Ryan, I mean, your example brings up how there's so much to think of in regards to just having mutual happiness and exchanges, but also just personal happiness.
Right.
I mean, you think about when you eat a meal and you're really happy about eating it, but then you might overeat, and then you'll
right.
be upset that you've had too much, right? So whereas I think as human beings with our moods kind of almost constantly in flux,
right.
it's hard to determine really what happiness is for us, right?
Right, and I mean, again, to think about this in environmental terms, right, again, Lambin helped us think about it again, is how is environmental degradation in this capacity tied to our happiness and to our well-being, right? In terms of, so obviously right now we're kind of circling around what happiness is, thinking through the environment, right? If we preserve things, if we conserve environmental things, if we make sure tiger and bird are both happy, that does something for us. How does that help our happiness? At the same time, how does environmental degradation, pollution, mountaintop removal, garbage island floating out in the ocean. I mean, how do these ideas, the quality of air going down, how do these things, environmental degradation, affect our happiness also, right? So there is this interesting tie here sort of between individual and environment.
Right. You know, an interesting parallel might be to bring back the beer skin.
Mm.
And we think about it. We love beer, each one of us here. I'm very sure of that. In the same way that people love to produce things, we love to create things. But we also, in this chain of the cycle of nature, we like to also, unfortunately, destroy things. So the removal of the mountaintop could be parallel to while drinking too much beer and losing your focus, falling off the wagon, so to say.
Fair point.
I mean, we love certain things with the ability that we're able to do by destroying some of our resources, but then we have to juxtapose what are the levels that we need to maintain a certain standard. And maybe we're looking at happiness in that way.
And looking at trying to figure out how we could achieve such a standard, I think Lambin's really pushing us to view our interactions with our environment not in terms of a management as a chore or, you know, responding to a serious threat such as climate change is just a negative occurrence that we need to respond to, but looking at it in a way that we can actually increase our own happiness by responding positively, right? By trying to find this balance that we've been addressing here through thinking about all of the impacts, not just
right.
how much we love beer, right? But also
right.
how much we might love the hops involved in this production,
mm,
the fields,
absolutely.
The ground, the soil. It's this whole kind of holistic approach to our interactions with the environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's access to fresh water and all these kinds of things. I mean, that's one of the things I like that Lamon points out, right, is just thinking about where this general train of thought kind of came from, right, that in the rise of the mid-20th century, we see things like life expectancy, average income, general health, the United States and a lot of Western nations, and around the world for many parts too, have improved. However, this happened as sort of it was made possible by economic power buying out, you know, the environment in essence. Like we can afford to produce more, but we do so at the cost of the environment. So while income goes up and life expectancy of humans may go up, this does come at an environmental cost.
And a huge cost, right? In economics, there's this idea of negative externalities, right, which really relates to this conundrum, right, of we might have economic growth, but then what is the cost? And I think
right.
Lamon really boils down, you know, how we can try to bring these costs into our thinking, where he presents us with five choices that humans have if we want to reconcile our quest for happiness with protecting the natural world. Number one, do we change our values from enjoying the material, right, what we've benefited from economically, to experiencing the natural? Do we continue to promote urban cultures or cultivate our biophilic tendencies? Try to have a balance, you know, not just concrete jungle, but trees and a combination. Do we change our relationships with animals? And I think this brings up what you're saying, Ryan, how we balance out our relationships with other species around us. Do we change the way that globalization has been used to benefit the very few into a social process that delivers returns to all? And this really addresses also with, as you were saying, Adam, with our economic growth, we've had issues of not only environmental degradation, but also socioeconomic divisions.
Hmm.
And the final point that Lamon brings up is, do we change from being egocentric to altruistic? And is this really a much better kind of way to conceptualize ourselves that could increase happiness?
These are all really good points to think on. And I think the direction that this is pushing is sort of away from the possibility of a Malthusian catastrophe, that being that we avoid overextending our resources to the point where we have nothing left to sustain a population as we understand it today. So would changing these relationships with nature, what are we sort of driving at as, or understanding nature as? How are we defining nature in this moment versus something that is unnatural, that we might be seeing going on concurrently right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we draw that into notions of design, there's a really interesting architect whose name is Friedensreich Hundertwasser. And
it's quite a mouthful.
It is, I know. His name is actually much longer than that, but I'm not going to even attempt to say the entire thing. But one of the famous examples of his work is called the Green Citadel of Magdeburg. It's in eastern Germany. And so he was doing design in the basically just the fall of the Soviet era and like sort of a little bit into post-communist era and into sort of the end of the fall of the Soviet Union. But one of the things that he talks about, he's famous for that, he had these architectural manifestos, and one of his things was to bring nature back into design because the material aspects that the humans make, the things that we make, he argued were these monstrosities, and that he loved moss. He wanted moss to be growing on walls, like the kind of stuff that grows in the back of a refrigerator. Kind of gross. I mean, he had notions that we need to come back to nature and that like all toilets and buildings need to be compost toilets. And that if we're not getting back to the soil, he basically said in his manifesto that we don't deserve to be part of nature. And the other kind of famous thing he says are straight lines are godless things. Nature does not design in straight lines. And so it's this really interesting mix of this sort of whimsicality. If you look again, the Green Citadel of Magdeburg, we'll put pictures of it on the website. This really wonderful Dr. Seussian pink building with wavy lines, and there's no straight lines in the entire building. But this notion that there can be sort of this harmony between human creative processes and design as well as natural production and what we might see in nature. And so I think that kind of gets to, for me anyway, that's something that I think we can attach to sort of what Lambin's talking about and what Ryan and Neil, you guys have been bringing up.
Absolutely. And you do see a lot of pushes in this direction. But first I want to comment that I'm not sure what fridge of yours has moss growing on the inside of it.
My science fridge.
But regardless of your moss fridge, there are pushes for houses to be made in the hollows in the ground, like hobbit holes. And I'm showing a picture now that we can put online later, that you have the idea that you can kind of create self-sustaining walls that are actually just made of grass and things around you, that you can kind of live in an area that's really tied to nature in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, we see some architects play with the ability to manipulate trees so that they grow in ways and contours that we can actually build into them organically.
Mm-hmm.
And these type of pushes are really adding to something more that's not only sustainable, but better for the environment, for more plants to be around, for more fresh air, for better quality of standard of living with connections to nature and the environment.
Sure. I mean, let's bring it back to happiness, right? This is even what Hunter Wasser said. It's really kind of cool. He actually has rooms in this apartment, the Green Citadel, that are just trees.
Right.
Those trees live in this apartment building, too. But this notion that if we can bring sort of back nature to what we, even as we design things, as we humans make things, there is a happiness associated with that. There's
exactly.
Well-being associated with that.
Now, what I just might use to counter this, and I feel like such a critic right now, but what is the cost for this type of standard of living at the moment? Because a parallel might be to think of something else that is minimizing a carbon footprint, something like the Tesla cars, for example, which are using electric engines or fully electric, and they're reducing any type of fossil fuel output. But that's $120,000 for your baseline car.
Well, sure, and you get the lithium for the batteries is incredibly environmentally cost a lot.
Right. But even for these homes that we're talking of, the right now these are things that are not necessarily attainable to everyone.
The average person, right? Well, and it takes again an architect with sort of the mad scientistness of Hunter Wasser to want to make this kind of
yes,
thing too.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
And I think with architects generally, you have this phenomena, right, where this kind of lack of considering the social costs, which it happens with so many projects that are even branded as green projects, right, that are going back, trying to do what Lambin seems to be proposing and being integrated with our environment, but then they'll build these, LEED green certified buildings in the middle of the desert, right, these massive complexes, or as, our examples that we're mentioning, we have very green buildings, but they might be incredibly expensive. Right. So, and I think a lot of this really relates to Marshall Solon's, right, with the original affluent society.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about possibly the easiest way to address our ecological problems or try to reframe our engagement with the environment in a way that might greatly increase our well-being is by looking at our wants, looking at our needs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Marshall Solon's in his article, The Original Affluent Society, he's taking this concept of the original affluent from an essay by John Maynard Keynes, right, the economist, who thought that 1950s society was an affluent society, was, a real peak of humanity where we had our needs were very much satisfied. But Solons critiques this and says, the original affluent society is actually hunter-gatherers, where you have very limited wants that are easily satisfied. These are the key criteria for Solon. And then you think about our society today, where so much stress is made because of the socioeconomic inequality, which even disallows people from participating in a positive ecological engagement,
mm-hmm.
right? When we have
Absolutely.
Green architects or people working in sustainability saying, oh, you need to buy this $100,000 electric car, or you need to be living in a green building. Well, what if you don't have the money to move to the green buildings being built?
Right.
As Ryan said, most of us don't have access to that kind of...
Absolutely. And Neil brings up a wonderful point, thinking about hunter-gatherers and the relationship to the environment. I mean, the average hour that a hunter-gatherer individual needs to put into procuring food and anything else that needs for a week is 20 hours. The rest of that time you have open and free to spend socializing, to engage in other types of activities, not to be restricted to any type of other working habit or practice.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about the man hours that are necessary, it frees up a lot of time that you can dedicate energy elsewhere while also being environmentally friendly. Another issue with this is health and diet. Hunter-gatherer societies, we know, have better statures. They had generally, people were achieving heights of 6 feet tall prior to 10,000 years ago, before the advent of cities. And with the advent of cities, with people using grains, health declines, cavities arise, problems with the body go up astronomically, and the stature of a normal individual drops over a foot. So we see that people are making 5 foot at max at the earliest cities, and it's a very stark difference from the type of health that you see with hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that ties us back. Those are great points that you both made. And, like, thinking about this relation between biology and sort of natural processes as well as then cultural changes, right? And that's what Solins points out, and Ryan, you're kind of pointing out the biological angle of that, is that, you know, we, of course, nature acts on us in objective ways. We are biological beings, and that we have to consume protein, liquid, water, have shelter, you know, and then on top of that, we can talk about Maslow's psychologist's hierarchy of needs, right? But we have to have certain things. But the way we do this is incredibly variable across the world, right? And then Solins helps us realize that when we talk about affluence, or even this is what Lamb and other people have called hegemonies of consumption now. We need to consume things, right? It sort of takes these needs that we have to eat and get shelter and really expand them in any kinds of ways. But as you're pointing out, Ryan, too, that there are physiological changes that happen. Of course, we see this over time. People's heights go down when they go from open savanna spaces and hunter-gathering societies into cities, into urban spaces.
Right.
Even with agricultural too, we do see specific changes. Now, what the important to think about then, of course, is that these, what we're seeing is cultural changes affect us biologically. And this brings us back to thinking about Lambert's argument, right, that in the ecology of happiness and well-being, how can this be produced, right? And these bring to the questions you mentioned before, Neil, that we can see physiological changes in the environment. And that's what he's kind of turning our attention to, right? It's our cultural actions, how they affect the physical environment. But then vice versa, how does the physical environment affect our cultural systems, right? And when the environment
Absolutely.
Is changing irreparably or in a very big scale, which we're seeing now for the first time ever, it raises questions about how we culturally live, you know, on a global scale.
And so with this, I think, you know, in summarizing this conversation, I think the key thing that we're trying to get at is that perhaps the way we're living right now is a chore, right? Perhaps this is the burden almost, kind of the everyday living or how our society is structured as it is right now. And what we could do to try to change our society would, you know, dramatically increase our well-being. That it's, you know, it's not that kind of reacting to climate change is going to be this horrible thing where our society will be, you know, degraded or we'll lose so many of the things that we like to do, but we'll find a new kind of reconceptualization of who we consider ourselves and what makes us happy.
Right. And we also are thinking about the goals. What do we want to be happy? What type of futures are we envisioning? And when you see the sort of rise of industry initially going on, you see a lot of novels having a future of a utopia sort of lined up, that people see this as a mechanism to bridge towards that possible future. But today we see often something a little bit more apocalyptic with our novels. We see more dystopian future that lies ahead, that we're almost the victims of our own progress, that we're bridging past that. So we see these sort of outlooks. We're almost monitoring or self-checking our own trends to push towards something that we see as a good direction or a bad direction. So right now we are recognizing, what is it to be happy and what is it to sustain happiness in that different level? What do we want? Because we want that utopia vision back. We don't want zombies overriding everything in Atlanta. And
and almost, I think through Lambin, we find almost a middle ground, right, between the utopia and the dystopia, where we can, where change is required, but then it can occur in a way that will, you know, reinvigorate ourselves in a way that will change society in a path where we can really try to be kind of in more balance with the world around us. And Solins gets to this as well. The architecture examples that we have, the Die Grün Zitadelle, right? I think it's also these attempts to really change our society and think about what future directions can we go in that might achieve, you know, a higher level of happiness.